Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Unauthorized Disclosure Podcast. I'm Kevin Gastola. I'm joined by Rania Kallek. Hello, Rania.
Hey, Kevin.
And we're very pleased to have as our guest this week, Jamil Dacquar, who is the director of the ACLU's Human Rights Program. Thanks, Jamil, for joining.
Thank you for having me on the show.
And so it's been a little over a week that we've had the Muslim ban, which was issued by Donald Trump as an executive order, of course, called the extreme vetting. And we wanted to have you on to talk about what happened in the last days. And I suppose, you know, there are many ways in which we could start off this interview, but I suppose we should probably lay some groundwork and just assess how it's been applied. So, you know, there's the way that the Trump administration claims it's applied, and then there's the way in which it's actually impacted Muslim immigrants and refugees. And can you talk about how it's actually impacted people?
Absolutely. So, because this executive order seemed to have been issued with not the right or the proper vetting, screening, studying it, we know that right now that even the Office of Legal Counsel has not really provided any meaningful legal analysis, but rather really rubber stamped this executive order. And it is politically motivated more than anything else. It's not it is not driven by serious or imminent threats of any kind that really warranted this kind of executive order. So it is really Trump following his promise on the political campaign to place a Muslim ban. Now, of course, it tweaked it in a way that it would look like it's not about Muslims. It's targeting only seven countries that have Muslim majorities, and it's we're talking about over 200 million people. Of course, it's a lot of people that will be covered by this ban, and of course, putting the fact that the ban itself places 90-day ban on the people entering from these seven countries: Iran, Iraq, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and Syria, and Yemen, and then 120-day suspension of all refugee admissions and indefinite suspension of refugees from Syria. Now, that is what is in the executive order. There are some exceptions. Some of the things that we have said clearly indicate that this is a Muslim ban is the fact that there were statements made before Trump was elected, after he was elected, and even the days after this ban or the executive order was signed. And in those media interviews, Trump and his surrogate said that basically there will be exceptions, there will be priority for Christian refugees. So clearly this is also favoring one particular kind of refugees to be able to benefit from the fact that the U.S. does have a very limited, by the way, resettlement refugee program. But in terms of how it has applied or has been implemented, you know, we still don't know all the facts, even though it's been a week since it was issued and signed. There has been many, many reports and documented cases of people who have been not allowed to board planes, have been stranded abroad, including people who had valid visas, including permanent residents. We've had people, entire families who've been made it all the way to the U.S. and yet they were detained at airports, deprived of food. There was a case of a Somali family that was on their way to Minnesota, and they got detained for almost 20 hours in Dulles International Airport. There were people who were handcuffed, mistreated, asked political questions about their activism. Their social media was monitored. We know about the case of a BBC reporter who was flying from London to O'Hare, Chicago Airport, was also detained, and he was asked to provide password to his iPhone so that they can monitor social media and see what kind of apps and things that he posted on social media. So the scope has been really targeting, obviously, mainly people who are Muslims and coming from those countries, although there were some people who were not Muslims but coming from those countries, and they were incidents that were reported by the media of non-Muslim. But the real issue was that people were denied entry to the country. The government really wanted to take immediate measures, including the fact that many of the visas were immediately revoked. The consulate or embassy in Baghdad, Iraq, sent emails or to applicants who had already received and vetted for a visa to the U.S. that their visas were suspended hours after the executive order was signed. Right now, just we are today on Friday, we just saw a report that the government said 100,000 visas were revoked. And it's so hard to get those visas in the first place, and people go through a robust and screening, and yet they are now taking every measure to try to prevent people from coming to the United States and sending this message that Muslims are not welcome, whether they are refugees or not. Then they will do that in a temporary basis right now, but I'm concerned that this will be a test. This is a testing the public scrutiny and the judicial scrutiny and how the political system is reacting, and to then decide whether they will expand it in the future.
Well, so, no, you just mentioned whether they'll be expanded in the future. And so I want to ask you two questions. First, to anybody who's listening, because I have a lot of family members who have visas here and who have green cards here. They live here, their lives are here, and now they're just scared to leave the country. My family's from Lebanon, so, it's not on the list, but there's been talk of expanding the list. So what would you recommend, I guess, for any of our listeners who might be in that position? They have a green card or a visa in this country. Should they not leave? And then also the other question I have is, we've been hearing that there may be plans to expand this to people who do have visas and green cards already in the country. Is that something that would even be possible? I don't think it'd be legal, and I'm sure you guys would fight it, but would it be a possibility?
Well, first question, for the people who are already in the United States and have valid visas and permanent residency and other lawful authorization to be in the United States, I think the device that has been given, even by government officials, if you have those visas, don't leave now because you may not be able to re-enter. You'll not be able to come back. So it would have to be obviously case by case. People have to get advice from immigration services or immigration attorneys or some ACLU affiliates across the country that are be able to help in providing, information about their concrete cases, because there's some people and confusion about that. For example, there's a case that we just heard of people who moved to the United States from South Sudan, but when South Sudan was part of Sudan. And as you know, South Sudan is now an independent country. It has its own visas, its own passports, and the United States recognizes South Sudan. Now, those people, what do they say? Do they say, we are from South Sudan, and that way they are not covered by the ban? When they came to the United States, they were from Sudan, because South Sudan did not exist as a country, as a state that is recognized under the UN and U.S. authorities. So there's a lot of confusion, and that obviously making people more anxious and more terrified about the whole thing. And I think the most important thing to know that people who are in the United States and have valid visas and even work visas and certainly the ones who are permanent residents, green card holders, if they are in the United States, they have more basis. The legal basis for the challenging, they're much, much stronger than people who are just outside the United States living and they are received a visa and their visa was revoked. Because if that is a fact, unfortunately, this is much harder. I mean, obviously, people who are legal residents and residing outside the United States or have dual citizenship, and there we have heard of some people who had dual nationalities from, for example, the seven countries and another European country, and they had trouble in getting into the U.S., and some of them were detained and turned away. The government has been giving some guidance, clarifying on the go, and they were not consistent. That is one of the things that we are trying to do now. The government need to provide full answers and have to clarify the scope of this. And the courts are now, that's the good news, is the courts are now part of this process. It's not just the media asking questions, or it's not just advocacy organizations or members of Congress. It's the court system, which is a major check on the government, is asking already, as you know. Several courts have issued stay denying or preventing the government from sending people, detaining people, or sending them back. And then that in of itself will, this challenge will be expanded to challenge the executive order and the ban as a whole, not just on the ground that the government cannot send some people back to those countries where they could be persecuted or they could be tortured, but the fact that the ban itself, that's something that the ACLU and other organizations are making the case, including CARE that filed the case earlier this week, is that the ban itself is unconstitutional on First Amendment ground because there is a discrimination against one religious denomination, one religion over the other. And that is the core protection that is part of the First Amendment and will be part of the challenge that we will see in the next few weeks and months.
So what if the Trump administration decides to change the language in their order so that it doesn't, so that they can claim it's not discriminatory and it's just targeting specific nationalities?
Well, that's part of the challenge, is that to prove intent that it is not, that is indiscriminatory on against a particular religion, which is what the law and the the Supreme Court in the case in the 80s have said, that this requires proving intent. We think that there's ample evidence to make the case why this executive order, even if they will be adding another country that doesn't have Muslim majority. If you remember, during the Bush years, after 9/11, Bush created the NCIRS program, the registration program that targeted predominantly, most of them were countries that have Arab-Muslim majorities. And the only country that did not have any significant Muslim community was North Korea, and even though that program at the time was not constitutionally challenged, I think that everybody perceived it as problematic, as illegal, and it's important to remember that program because I think about 140,000 people registered under that program, people who were in the United States, who were legally in the United States, but they just came from those 25 countries or 26 countries, and even after all the the announcements that this is an important security measure to counter terrorism, not a single case of the people who were registered, was the government prosecuted in federal court and terrorism charges were not. So it was totally counterproductive, totally a waste of resources, and because we said in the very beginning that people who would want to do harm or to commit illegal acts, We're not going to go and register in the first place. And by just profiling entire communities, that doesn't make any good for the protection of the country. So now, obviously, there are some people probably in the Trump administration that are looking at the lessons learned from this experience and trying to design a program that doesn't necessarily mean that it's only targeting Muslim. That's why they're saying, oh, this is not just about Muslims, it's about terrorism. But the truth of the matter is that no, and that the facts clearly show that there's not a single act of terrorism or act of federal prosecution that has been successful against anyone on U.S. soil from any of the seven countries included in the executive order.
Go ahead, Kevin.
Well, so I wanted to ask about the way in which this administration approaches Islam, because for the most part, you hear the way officials talk, and I think this has been picked up on by others who have followed this closely, which is they treat it more like a political ideology than a religion. and mm-hmm. and that seems to head towards a direction of, you know, going after it in the way in which our country tried to stamp out, you know, maybe communists or something, that they, that the people who are running our country right now in the Trump administration really see what they're doing as a war against political ideologues that have entered our country. And, you know, we see, I mean, along with that, I would add for you to comment on how he wants to, how the Trump administration wants to focus the counter-extremism program just solely mm-hmm. on Muslim communities. And obviously, we know that it's been mostly focused on their communities anyways, but he wants to remove all resources from looking into white supremacist groups or any other groups that might have been monitored. Can you address this?
Yes, of course. This is a really dangerous thing that is going on here, because if you think about it, if you're saying that Islam is not a religion, it's a political ideology, or you say, as Flynn, the national security advisor to the president, said, or even the attorney general nominated as attorney general, Jeff Sessions, said, you know, it's a toxic religion, or other statements that were made, including the president himself. When you think about that, and you think about the measures that are being taken, that stripping of Americans and others who are not Americans, but just the millions and billions of people out around the world who belong to Islam, this is their faith. If you say that this is not a religion, what that means for people who are in America is that you basically cannot invoke religious rights under the Constitution, mm-hmm. because if they are not a religion, if this is just a political ideology or some sort of a political movement, well, yes, you may have some constitutional rights, but you may not have the standing to invoke or to claim that you have constitutional rights as a religious minority, as members of a religious denomination that should be protected from being disfavored under the First Amendment. So that in of itself, this is really one of the most dangerous thing to do, that when you are demonizing and you are trying to take a whole group of people belonging to a religion outside the protection of the Constitution, outside the protection of the law, and to argue that that is because their religion is not recognized by the government, by the country. And so, of course, there will be a huge pushback against that. And we see that in reaction to the Muslim ban, because that's precisely what they are intending to do. But we've seen this movement building during the past several years. We worked at the ACLU, we worked on the so-called anti-Sharia laws. And what they intended to do, you know, there are like dozens of bills around the country in state legislatures that basically said state court should not consider Sharia law as part of their judicial decision making. They should not consider it in courts. And the first formulation was, it was broader than that. It wasn't just about Sharia law. It was about also foreign law and international law. And then we challenged it in Oklahoma and we won. After even a referendum, two-thirds of Oklahoma residents said that they wanted to amend the Constitution and to ban the use of foreign law, Sharia law, and international law. And the court clearly said, you can't do that because Sharia law is part of a faith, and people are following this faith. This is part of the religion, and when you do that, you are excluding them and you're disfavoring this religion, and that would be violating the Constitution, the First Amendment. And that movement of anti-Sharia law, obviously not making any facts about how Sharia law really was threatening, you know, U.S. law or constitutional system in the United States. It was based on, again, it was just a fake news thing that was going on for a number of years. And even though many of these bills were thrown out, were challenged, and they lost, they're now in the mainstream. They're now in the White House trying to make those arguments. And the way that they want to do it, they're building it by saying, we don't want people in this country who belong to this faith to be recognized as religious minorities. They don't deserve to be recognized as such. We will ban them from coming to the country. We will take them out of the political system because they should not be empowered and should not be able to have a voice. And so that's why we think that this ban should be challenged and should be rejected as a first attempt, as a test to see whether the public, you know, the political system, Congress, the courts will accept that. And if it will be accepted and normalized, then other measures will be taken to expand it. And that's, I think, the slippery slope that we are, warning against.
Wow, there's so much, there's a lot of dangerous things going on here, and what you just explained is one of them. And another side of this that I was really kind of frightened by was how there was the stay that was handed down by a federal court, but the Border Patrol just didn't listen to it. They disregarded it. Is this like a constitutional crisis at that point when you've got a group of, I guess, police or whatever, domestic police that are listening to the executive over the judicial branch?
Well, you know, CBP has been an agency that resisted accountability and transparency for many years. The ACLU, and particularly our affiliates in the border states, have been particularly focusing on the Border Patrol and CBP officials there. And they consider themselves as paramilitary, agency. They don't think that they are a law enforcement. And they always resisted accountability and transparency. And even when the Obama administration tried to rein in, even though Obama administration, by the way, expanded the Border Patrol agents on the ground, 35% the number of officials and agents on the ground. But the people who are dealing with the orders now and trying to resist complying with the court orders are the people not necessarily at the port of entries at the southern border, but mostly in airports around the country. And we've seen and we've heard about many cases where they did not follow and did not comply and even did not allow people to meet with lawyers, did not allow members of Congress in certain circumstances in Dulles International Airport. And that's why we are now filed in 50 states, all of ACLU 50 affiliates in the 50 states, Freedom of Information Act request, requiring information about CBP and how they are implementing the executive order and to find out more information about how they are doing it, because we believe that there's a connection between the fact that they may be some instances of not complying, but the overall problem is that lack of accountability and transparency, especially when you have an agency, its own union, for the first time in its history, decided to endorse Trump as a president. There's also this politicization of an agency that should not be above the law, that should be accountable to the courts and to the Constitution.
The Trump administration apparently thinks that when you're questioned at an airport about your political views, that you're not being detained, or that this is not detention, and so we shouldn't care too much or fret too much about that. But I mean, can you tell us all why that is so obviously wrong?
Well, you know, the there's a lot of racial profiling and a lot of religious profiling that happens in the country. But when it happens at the border and the entry port of entries and at airports in particular, there's a very big challenge there, because in some instances the courts in general have been deferring to the authorities that in this area of a border control or an airport where the government can basically take some of those measures of asking questions that relate to admission of individuals or returning people to the United States. Some of that, especially if it goes into religious lines and targeting people because of their religion, would be obviously very problematic and would have raised constitutional concerns. And several years ago, when the Bush administration was using them, we had a case of the New York Civil Liberties Union and the ACLU National represented Muslim Americans who were traveling to Canada to attend a conference, which was like one of those largest conferences of Muslim in North America. And on their way back, the whole group of people who were traveling, including with their family members and children, were detained at the way back in the border crossing, and that resulted in litigation. And we've been trying very much to look for additional cases that would highlight the problematic nature of this kind of questioning, because they sometimes pose those questions as if they are neutral, or they're raising them, oh, these are questions that are everyone is asked, but the truth of the matter is that a lot of those questions are problematic and could even be unconstitutional, because if they target people just because of their religion, and because of their and even sometimes if they're targeting them for political activism, which we were seeing now, is really opening a new era of McCarthyism that you know is going to happen not just in a committee, but it's really all over the place, where people moving around, coming in and out of the country, getting into different places, they will be asked. And think about it. This is not only going to be about religious profiling. This is going to be also impacting what this administration wants to do. It's going to be impacting other minorities as a whole, other minorities, including, you know, Latinos, African American, and you know, Native Americans, who will already subject to these kinds of practices. But we will see it even expanded to LGBT communities or minorities, because with the government intending to, for example, give a free hand for discrimination on basis on religious freedom, people will start to ask, oh, are you LGBT person? And if they will discriminate against them. And this White House seems to be okay with that. And that really is the challenge. This is targeting now Muslims and as a main challenge and threat to them. But it's expanding, and it's likely to include everybody, just like Trump said on the political campaign. He said that things that really didn't leave any community, particularly people of color and other minorities, not to be concerned about what he's intending to do. And that's, I think, what the ACLU is preparing for. It's not just this challenge against the ban. We're going to be challenging religious refusals. We will be also looking at other actions by the Trump administration that will have serious concerns under the Constitution and obviously under international law with regard to human rights and civil liberties.
Well, thank you, Jamil. We really appreciate you taking the time to do this interview with us.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, and just one last thing. If people who might be listening, if them or their family members come, you know, into any issues because of this ban, who should they contact?
Well, first thing is to contact the local ACLU, because if they are in, and they would have the way to respond to their requests. We have developed also Know Your Rights materials about what happens to you. You can find it online. So I would suggest that people contact the local ACLU in your state. Some affiliates for some states have more than one chapter within the state. Obviously, we have the national ACLU. The website has many materials, Know Your Rights and other things. And we are continuing to work with other partner organizations to make sure that people have responses to their questions, and because there's serious crisis now, and people legitimately are very concerned about their families, about their communities. So we urge people to, and those who are also in a position to provide advice, if they are immigration lawyers or lawyers who have expertise in this area, to come forward and to contact our affiliates and to offer their services and pro bono support to the communities where they live, because that will be essential in making sure that people are ready and will have resources to defend themselves.
Well, on that note, thank you so much, Jamil. We really, really appreciate all the work the ACLU is doing. You guys have been great on this. And hopefully we'll have better news soon and we can have you back on to talk about how we defeated all these measures. But in the meantime, keep up the excellent work.
Thank you so much, Ronnie. Thank you, Kevin.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the discussion portion of the Unauthorized Disclosure podcast. I'm Kevin Gastola, joined by Rania Calicolo. Hey, Rania.
Hey, Kevin.
And before we get into our show, we want to thank everyone who donated to us the past month. We're really appreciative of everyone who is supporting our work. And we wanted to acknowledge a few people
First off, we got this really great email from John, who sent us something about how he wanted to echo the sentiments expressed on our show by a fellow Southerner. He's from Knoxville, Tennessee. And though I have plenty of liberal, progressive-minded friends, it's easy to feel discouraged given that there is no chance through voting where I live to affect national politics. And then he goes on and he talks about being from the South. And we just were very appreciative that he you know, sent this to us. He talked about how he found you. He heard you, Rania, on Secular Talk.
Great show, by the way, Secular Talk. Kyle Kulinski is the host, and he's awesome, and you should watch it.
And also, he likes the Katie Halper show.
Katie's
and
awesome.
And so, you know, it's great that, like, we're getting people who are also part of the listening, part of the audiences for other great programs out there. So thank you, John. We thank you for deciding to patronize our show, as you said. And then also, I just wanted to read and let Matthew know that we got his message. He talked about being glad to support our show, and he said, hope we keep bringing hard-hitting journalism in the dark days ahead. And then he had some recommendations for some guests: Immortal Technique, Glenn Ford, Cornel West, Chris Hedges, Bruce Dixon, Jeremy Scahill, someone from the anarchist movement, and Richard Wolff. And we think these are all great ideas, and we're considering some of them for future shows.
Yeah, so thank you for the recommendations. And thank you for writing. We always love to read what people have to say. So if you ever want to write to us, you know, feel free to. Especially if you become a Patreon supporter. Yeah. And which you should, by the way. I definitely encourage you to support the show. The more support it gets, the better we can make it.
Yeah, all of those people were sending messages to our creator account on Patreon. We also have I think it's probably been like 2 years since we opened it, but we do have a Gmail account. It's like unauthorized disclosure.
Dude, I didn't even know that.
Okay, well, after we get done, we're going to have to go figure out if it still exists. I mean, maybe Google just shut it down because we haven't used it for so long.
Maybe. It doesn't bode well. If anybody was like about to send the email, they're probably like, never mind.
All right. Messages on Patreon. That's how we'll get back to you.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So moving on to, I guess, Jesus Christ, Trump is still president.
Yes.
And I decided he looks like a Cheeto. That's not true. I didn't decide that. Somebody else said it. I don't remember who, but I think it's really funny. You know, whenever I look at him, I think of a Cheeto.
Well, my favorite thing, insult, is a mangled apricot hell beast.
Jesus. That sounds too fancy. Like, Cheeto just sounds as trashy as he is.
Yeah, true.
So I guess, like, you know, we're probably going to start a little heavy with what we're going to talk about, but we were talking before we started recording, and so I think it's something we should talk about on the show. And that is, after everything that's happened this week, or the past 2 weeks, with the Muslim ban and the, you know, the ramp up of the anti-refugee hate, I think that there's something that we should talk about, which is, you know, I think for a long time, the left, whatever, and again, like, I never really know what that means. It's just like kind of a blanket statement of people who aren't right wing or centrist. But the left has, I think, really conceded the security argument to the right, not on purpose, but I think that we have to have a better argument, like, as people on the left, we have to have a better argument about the refugee crisis other than just moralistic platitudes, and especially with the Muslim ban. Like, the moralistic platitudes, they're important. It's important to have, you know, the morals on your side and to be moralistically right. But it's also important to have, like, to be able to answer the right's arguments, if that makes sense,
yeah,
with better arguments.
Well, so before you get too far, do you want to define the left? Like, do you think for this part of our show, we should name what that means to you? Or, because, I mean, some people would say that, like, Hillary Clinton doesn't deserve to be part of the left.
No. Like, I definitely don't mean Hillary Clinton. I don't mean the corporate wing of the Democratic Party. I would include, like, the Sanders part of the Democratic Party. Like, Keith Ellison and Sanders are, like, you know, the right of the left, if that makes sense. They're progressives, though. Like, I would include progressives and some liberals mostly, like, liberals are usually more centrist, but even some liberals, but mostly progressives, and then people who consider themselves left to the, like, you know, even more left to the progressives, especially Marxists and anarchists and anybody else who really considers themselves to be a part of the left. I really think it's crucial. I don't know if that's a good enough definition,
yeah,
but I mean, the people who are really responding the loudest against Trump's ban, and they're right to. But one thing that I've noticed is there is some acknowledgement that, yes, U.S. foreign policy has created lots of problems in the Middle East. And, you know, a lot of the countries that Trump banned are countries the U.S. has bombed and destroyed. And it's really good people point that out. But I think we need to go further than just that, because I think it's bigger than that. I think that there's also a fear factor here. And I'm not legitimizing any of the Islamophobia that's taken place in this country, especially coming from Trump. There's a huge Islamophobia industry dedicated to fear-mongering about Muslims. Every time, and that because of that, every time any Muslim anywhere does anything violent in the name of religion, it's immediately, like, plastered on every single newspaper headline, you know, every single newspaper front page, and, like, it's 24/7 cable news, you know, about terrorists and you know, and Islamic extremism. And, you know, we've been dealing with that since 9/11, just constant flooding in your brain, if you live in America, of constant fear-mongering about Muslims. There's also the fact that, you know, there is something, you know, there are people who are violent jihadists. That's just a fact. And I think that because of all that, it makes it easier for the right to scare Americans. Like, I was really surprised, Kevin, to find that 50% of Americans, according to a poll that Reuters did, 50% of Americans support Trump's ban. A lot of them do because they think it's going to make the U.S. safer. Like, they really think he's just keeping out, like, Al-Qaeda or something. And that's bullshit, right? That's total bullshit. But we do need to be able to respond to that argument, because the thing is, arguments about Al-Qaeda, fear of Al-Qaeda, that's all really emotional. And when people are emotional, they don't think rationally. And so it's really hard to, like, convince them with moralistic platitudes when they're scared. So that's one thing I think it's really important that the left needs to, like, respond to in a better way. And here's how I propose responding to that. When I talk to people, and this generally, like, I think works, like, I've talked to people on the right and they usually start to agree with me on this to an extent, is, look, the U.S. has spent the last several decades, especially the last 15 years, but collapsing states in the Middle East. And by collapsing those states, it's opened up vacuums for Al-Qaeda groups. Worse than that, the U.S. has repeatedly, time and again, allied with Islamic extremists, like, they've allied with religious extremists in the Middle East to basically do the dirty work against their adversaries. The U.S. did it in Afghanistan by arming the Mujahideen, and 20 years later, you know, 9/11 happened, and it was done by, like, a bunch of dudes who were part of Al-Qaeda, which, you know, the precursor organization to that was the Mujahideen. And so then, you know, Al-Qaeda became our enemy. But then again, in Syria, what did the U.S. do? And I've talked about it on the show, is the U.S. once again, you know, allied with violent jihadists who, you know, include, like, and that includes empowering the U.S. policy in Syria, basically armed Al-Qaeda linked rebels and empowered Al-Qaeda. Now it has its biggest affiliate in history. It also empowered ISIS because of, you know, by arming the rebels and diverting resources away from the Syrian army. The Syrian army wasn't able to deal with ISIS every time that ISIS would take something over. So the U.S. policy also empowered ISIS. And the point is this is a case where the U.S. used jihadists to do its dirty work. And that is something that I think that everybody from the left to the right should be disgusted and really angry about. That's something that our government keeps doing, is allying with these people. And I want to also note, like, you have to be honest about what Al-Qaeda is. And I used to be the kind of person, Kevin, who would say, oh, but, you know, Al-Qaeda is just responding to, like, you know, foreign policy grievances, right? And there are a lot of U.S., like, there are a lot of foreign policy grievances that they say they have, but Al-Qaeda also blows up, like, Shia mosques in Baghdad. You know what I mean? Al-Qaeda also kills minorities. Al-Qaeda also does terrible, horrific things to women. And those aren't for foreign policy grievances. It's a really, like, Al-Qaeda is a cultish organization. It's not natural to the region at all. In fact, religious extremism wasn't natural to the region. There were some religious extremists, and the U.S. just started empowering them starting in like the 50s against communism and against the Soviets by allying with the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt against Arab nationalism. So the point is like, this is a disaster that the U.S. has created. And on top of that, the U.S. has also, because of bombing all these countries, and especially what we did in Syria, has created this refugee crisis that they won't even take credit for, especially Democrats. Democrats have really like spun this tale about how the refugee crisis is all the fault of just, you know, authoritarian regimes in the Middle East. I was at this press conference a few days ago, and all of these senators spoke, and it was in front of the Supreme Court about the ban. And then there was a couple of refugees who spoke, and one of them was a Syrian refugee. And he told the crowd that, you know, this isn't our fault. It's all Assad's fault. Assad did it all. Assad's the reason there's a refugee crisis. And you can say that all you want until you're blue in the face. But the fact of the matter is the U.S. prolonged a civil war in Syria that created a refugee crisis. They empowered al-Qaeda in Syria. That's created a refugee crisis. And they've empowered al-Qaeda across the region in Libya as well. They've empowered ISIS in Libya and creating a refugee crisis. Like, this shit needs to be discussed more openly and talked about. I don't know why people are so scared to discuss it, because if you don't start talking about the fact that the U.S. has really empowered violent jihadists that creating this refugee crisis and then putting us in a situation where you actually do need to, you do need to like talk about the security issue, because there is a security issue now. There are people who are blowing shit up across Syria, across Lebanon, across Iraq, and like sometimes those people want to come here and do that stuff. And we have to have a better argument than just, you know, this sort of like, let's all just hug each other and there's no such thing as bad, like as jihadists. Like, I just feel like it's like a losing argument that way. I don't know if that makes sense, Kevin.
It just seems that we have to have a dual policy for beating back this turn towards fascism, for lack of a better word. I know that that gets thrown around pretty easily. But not only do you need to talk about how we should be accepting of refugees, that we should be accepting of migrants and not be forcing them to answer political questions about their views on Donald Trump, or that we shouldn't be asking them to answer for what country they were born in, or ask scholars that are studying here to inform on extremist groups in their home countries. But we also need to be promising that we're going to oppose the further destabilization of these countries, because, you know, you're not saying anything controversial. You really aren't, because the State Department in their yearly reports document countries and the rise of terrorism in them. And if you go back to just go back 2 or 3 years, you know, I did a post where I looked at the countries, many of them which are countries of origin in which people are being blocked from entering the United States now. And they were talking about how terrorism had actually escalated and increased and gotten worse. Mm-hmm. And they didn't link it to U.S. activities, but it just so happens that the parallel here is that the more U.S. operations that we've had in those countries, the more we've been a magnet for this kind of extremism, for the jihadism that you're talking about. And, you know, that is an objective fact. You know, whether people want to make it a cause and effect, I don't know. But the fact that we show up in those theaters, that makes it an arena in which al-Qaeda wants us to be there to fight these battles.
Well, it's not even just that. Actually, it's not even just that. It's actually the fact that the U.S., what it does is it collapses the state. I mean, that's what we did in Iraq. That's what we did in Libya. And that's where groups like al-Qaeda and ISIS thrive, is when there's a power vacuum, when there's no state, when it's just like when everything descends into anarchy and lawlessness. That's where they thrive. And also, that's a problem. The reason, the fact that groups like this exist, we also have to consider the U.S. alliance with Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia, it's the most tyrannical country in the world. I don't know how the fuck it's allowed to exist the way it does in 2017. But it is. It has, and it practices as a state, form of state religion. They're, you know, it's Wahhabism, which is, you know, this very strict, psychotic genocidal, you know, sect of Sunni Islam. And Saudi Arabia, we know, and in concert with the U.S., has spread Wahhabism. And they themselves, I mean, they build, they do it. They've spent hundreds of millions, I believe, wait, maybe hundreds of billions of dollars around the world, trying to really remake Sunni Muslim populations into the image of Saudi Arabia. And by preaching Wahhabism, I mean, the Kosovo is a great example. Like, not that long ago, Kosovo was, you know, has a lot of Muslims, and they were pretty secular, like really liberal and secular. And, as soon as the war was over and, you know, Kosovo came into being, Saudi Arabia started spending money on these massive mosques, and people started training imams from Kosovo and then sending them back to Kosovo. And suddenly you had like Wahhabist preachers really like indoctrinating the younger generations. And you saw this really harsh, like, turn towards really like ultra conservative right wing Wahhabi ideology. And then now Kosovo is a place where whenever there's a jihad to go fight anywhere, you always find people from Kosovo. There's people from Kosovo and Syria. So I don't know. It's like it becomes Saudi Arabia's own little mercenary army where they can just like send people, just like the imams that they pay at these mosques, they can send them in to go fight somewhere. And Saudi Arabia has done this in so many places. They fund shit in like Indonesia. They fund stuff in the South Asia, and they fund, I mean, everywhere there's, like, they do it in Lebanon. And it's really like they have remade whole populations. I'm not joking when I say that. It's really fucking disturbing. And so now in the Middle East, you have people who, like, for the last 20 years, you know, they've had like an upbringing in some like Wahhabi mosque. And I mean, like, let me just be clear, like Wahhabism, Kevin, it really does. It preaches like genocide against the Shia. Like the Shia have to die. They're all infidels or apostates or worse. Sometimes they call them the devil. Like Christians should be killed. Jews should be killed. Minorities should be killed. Women who don't do this should be stoned. Like it's all of the sort of Islamophobic tropes you can possibly think of are actually like just people confusing Wahhabism for Islam as a whole. Because Wahhabism is Wahhabism. Like it's like stoning people, and it's the kind of harsh interpretation of Islamic law that you know, Frank Gaffney always refers to when he thinks of all Muslims. What he actually is talking about is Wahhabism. But the point is that is our best friend in the region. Okay, and that is like that ideology is responsible. That and Salafism, which is like basically sort of the same thing, those are responsible for terrorism in the region, for people exploding themselves, for people bombing civilians, the terrorism that has proliferated across the Middle East and that every so often makes its way into Europe and makes its way into the U.S. It's Saudi Arabia is the inspiration for that. And like, we have to fucking contend with that. Nobody wants to talk about it. No one, not even on the left. Like sometimes people will on the left, but no one really wants to think and consider like how damaging this has been. And I mean, one of the really scary parts is, I mean, Saudi Arabia really wants to be like the leader of the Sunni Muslim world. And it's like, they're the Sunni Arab, like, they're like the sort of like leaders of the Sunni Arab identity. And that's really dangerous if that becomes the case. That's kind of what they've managed to do in a lot of the Middle East. So I guess my point is, and I'm going to sort of segue here, unless there's something else you'd like to add to that.
Well, we don't have to go into it. I think this is probably for a future show to get into it deeper.
Mm-hmm.
But I do want to say that the stakes are much higher and much more dire, and the risks are much more intense with this administration than they were with Barack Obama because of the nature of the people in which Trump has decided to populate his administration, particularly individuals like Stephen Bannon, who seem committed to Christian fascist crusades against Islam throughout the entire whole of Europe and the Middle East, you know, wanting to take on this, I suppose, mission is the way you should treat it, because he sees
holy
himself
war.
As like a, yeah, it's holy war. And that was, you know, I got a huge response, because the thing that really resonated with me the most about Trump's inaugural address wasn't America first. It wasn't American carnage. It was the call for holy war that ran throughout his entire inaugural address. The fact that he was talking about us being protected by God, the fact that he was talking in ways that, you know, he didn't use the word crusade, but he could have. If he had, it would have fit perfectly into what he was saying. You know, he was saying, when you open your heart to patriotism, there is no room for prejudice. The Bible tells us how good and pleasant it is when God's people live together in unity. And we will be protected by the great men and women of our military and law enforcement. And most importantly, we are protected by God. So that means that whatever sort of U.S. military force is taken by Donald Trump, Steve Bannon, Jared Kushner, whoever else is behind the influence on the military, you know, it is just, it is right. There isn't any way, reason to question it, because they are putting this Christianity veneer onto all of what they're doing.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. And that's you're absolutely right. The stakes are so high right now. And don't forget also, like, all the people that they're riling up who are starting to think like them or already do. I mean, we have to be able to, like, push back against that. And if we can't talk about these things openly, then we cede the conversation to the holy warriors. I mean,
because they're in the Navy SEALs, the SEAL Team 6 people, the people that go on these raids, which I don't know if that's where you were headed to talk about, that continuing to talk about that region in the world. But you know, the people there who are being sent in to do these operations, the kill and capture operations, the targeted assassinations, you know, they're holy warriors themselves.
Exactly. And where I was going to segue into, actually, is the irony of everything happening right now. You've got this Trump administration that's so Islamophobic, that hates terrorists and hates jihadists so much, right? And so what do? To fight ISIS, they're going to defeat ISIS, right? They're going to wipe ISIS out. What do? They ban Iranians from coming to the country and now want to go to war with Iran. Okay, here's the thing. For people who are not familiar, Iran is a majority Shia country, and Iran is actually fighting ISIS in Syria, and in the Iranian militia, like a backed militias in Iraq, also fighting ISIS. ISIS is a Sunni group that was largely came into being and received funding and support from Sunni Gulf countries that the U.S. is friends with, like Saudi Arabia and like Qatar and Kuwait. that's the issue in the Middle East right now. I'm not trying to get sectarian here, but the fact of the matter is that in the Middle East, the kind of terrorism that scares everyone is mostly done by Sunni groups. I mean, Iran isn't attacking America, and I don't believe it has, actually. You know, Hezbollah is a Shia group, and I'm not saying they're perfect. They're also, like, I don't like religious groups. I don't like people who identify themselves as religious, but they're not genocidal and they're not Al-Qaeda. They actually are fighting Al-Qaeda and ISIS in both Lebanon and Syria. It's insane to me I guess it's just pure ignorance, but even Trump supporters, I'm like looking at it from their perspective, you know, like if I was this person who was like really like terrorism's all I care about, and like, I'm really, you know, America first and got to deal with the terrorists, I'd be like, well, why are you punishing and wanting to go to war with the country that isn't actually behind the terrorism and is actually fighting the terrorists? You know what I mean? Just, it's nuts. But, you know, that's what's happening right now, is that Trump has allied himself with the monarchs of Saudi Arabia against Iran. And now it seems like there's like an obsession with Iran inside his administration, people like Michael Flynn. And increasingly, it seems like we might go to war with Iran. I thought it was really funny, though, I got to say, you know, Trump announced these new sanctions against Iran. And the Iranians responded by saying that they're going to sanction American individuals and entities that are responsible for supporting terrorism in the region. And all I could think was, oh my God, are they going to sanction the Atlantic Council and like Charles Lister?
Yeah. And you know, everyone laughs at Michael Flynn coming in and going that we're going to put Iran on notice. And then I think Iran just basically shrugged
and was like, you're not going to do anything to us.
Well, America can't really, here's the thing. Trump is totally unhinged, and he clearly does not, like, him and his administration, they don't think very rationally. So maybe he will go to war with Iran. You know what will happen if the U.S. went to war with Iran? Like, U.S. soldiers would start dying in both Iraq and Afghanistan. Iran, if you hit Iran, like, Iran has huge stakes in Iraq. Iran has militias in Iraq. And there are U.S. soldiers in Iraq. And that's, like, they will turn those militias on U.S. soldiers. No question about it. Also, Afghanistan, things would go really south for the U.S. and Afghanistan because Iran is totally involved in that effort. And they could easily, like, turn it into, like, a bad situation for the U.S. There's also the fact that Iran could hit U.S. Bases in various, like, countries like Bahrain. You know, Iran could escalate a lot of shit. Like, there's a lot of little proxy sectarian wars across the Middle East where the U.S. is on one side of it. And Iran could easily turn it up. And beyond that, I mean, you've also got countries that do a lot of business with Iran, like India and, what's it called? The other one? No, India and... No, what's the other one? India and China. I was like, what's the other big country?
Oh, yeah. China.
India and China. And, of course, Russia is, like, a really good, a close Iranian ally, and they have a lot of business interests in Iran. Like, these countries are not going to let the U.S. go after, especially Donald Trump. It's not even like it's a leader they like in the U.S., you know? Mm-hmm. So it would be a disaster. And also, don't forget, Iran could hit Israel. And that's, like, you know, Israel's America's precious gem that you're not supposed to touch. And so the point is Iran could do a lot of damage to the U.S. I'm not talking about on the ground face-to-face combat. I just mean in the region. And so I just, like, don't see that practically happening. But then again, who the fuck knows? Because these people are crazy.
Well, I believe that they're not going to go to war in Iran, but they'll want to go to war with Iran, and they'll transform the already hellish and poor lands of Yemen into an even more intense war zone. I mean, the Navy is, like, they moved the destroyer off of the coast of Yemen. They moved the USS Cole closer to pose as a kind of threat to Iran proxies. I mean, they see they want to heighten tensions, and they're pursuing this very aggressively. We know the extent to which this war has been going on in Yemen for the past years and how much devastation has gone on, but it just seems like they're willing to let it get worse and continue to be even more devastating.
Well, you know, and that's another thing that is kind of usually missing in the coverage of Yemen is the sectarian side of it. And what I mean by that is that, you know, Yemen has a fairly large Shia population. That said, like, if you look at a map of Yemen, it's, like, kind of like the bottom of Saudi Arabia. And so the Shia population there is always sort of, I guess, posed a threat in a way. Like, you know, Saudi Arabia hates the Shia. The Shia in Saudi Arabia are very, very oppressed. And there's this, like, big population of Shia in Yemen, and the Houthis, I guess, are a part of that. And they've always sort of had, I guess, what you could say, like, is, like, some sort of revolutionary potential. And that's a part of this, is just keeping that in line, that revolutionary potential in line, and making it about Iran. I mean, I don't even think Iran is really giving that much support to the Houthis in Yemen.
I don't think they really need to. I mean, that's been a long-standing thing. You know, before this escalated 2 or 3 years ago, there was always intense, I guess, separatism from the Houthis that, like, Ali Abdullah Saleh had to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Well, they were never given any power. Yeah. Like, they're a big part of the country. They're, like, a grassroots, like, they have grassroots support, and they've never given any power at all. Like, any new power has ever been shared with them. But the point is, like, there is a sectarian element to it. And so that's when we talk about, like, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, or ACAP, the Al-Qaeda branch in Yemen. Al-Qaeda, like, basically the U.S. is fighting on the side of Al-Qaeda in Yemen, even though every once in a while. No, they are.
But they could be. I mean,
They could, but they launched the...
They like in Syria. Like, look, every once in a while, you'll see them hit al-Qaeda, like, every so often. But they also just kind of let al-Qaeda do their dirty work. Like, the Houthis were fighting al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
And if that's our big threat, if our big threat to al-Qaeda, why are you backing a war against the people who are fighting them? Like, it makes no sense. And so, essentially, the U.S. is fighting... That's what I mean, that they're fighting on the same side as al-Qaeda. Saudi Arabia basically, like, uses them as their mercenaries in Yemen. So... Al-Qaeda, and that's why, because they're fighting the group that fights al-Qaeda in Yemen, al-Qaeda's actually been empowered by the war on Yemen. They've been empowered dramatically. And so, it's a certain similarity in a way with Syria. The U.S. wasn't directly giving weapons to al-Qaeda. It was giving weapons to groups that had the same ideology as al-Qaeda and worked with al-Qaeda. And then every so often, for show, you know, you'd hear Obama, like, had some drone strikes in Idlib or something and took out a couple al-Qaeda leaders. But it was also, never anything that significant. The point is what's happening in Yemen, the systematic destruction and starvation of that country is like, a part of it is sectarian, a part of it is just to maintain control of the oil. There's like an oil route that goes around Yemen, you know, for trade. That's partly why Egypt's involved, for like energy reasons. And it's just really fucked up what's happening. But I think you're right that it's like, it could become, I guess they might just ramp up in Yemen, but it makes no sense to, it's like, you're not even really fighting Iran there. If that's your purpose to fight Iran, right?
Unless the generals tell you, you can't go to war, you can't actually attack Iran, its infrastructure inside the country. You can't go after even military targets within that country because of the response that Iran's going to have because of the repercussions. So you fight a proxy war, and
but it's not. But what I'm saying is, it's not even like really. At the end of the day, it's not exactly a proxy war in that sense. Like,
well, I'm not saying that it's particularly rational. I mean, let's look at the people who are behind wanting to do all of this. I mean, Flynn is clearly a rather unhinged kind of ideologue when it comes to security and the way in which he talks about taking care of the United States. But
I just can't for the life of me. Like, Flynn will say these things about Iran where he's like, they're the source of all evil. They're so Islamic. And it's like, but you're friends with the Saudis. Like, how is it possible? I don't understand how one is evil and the other one is your friend. Like, they're both theocracies. And if anything, Saudi Arabia is way fucking worse. Like, if I had to choose it, but they're trying to live in Iran or Saudi Arabia, no question I would choose Iran. I think most people would agree with me. Like, this doesn't make any sense to me. It's like, God, I really hate these Muslim terrorists. Give me Bin Laden on the line. Like, let me talk to him and figure out how we can deal with these Muslim terrorists. It's just crazy. It doesn't make any sense. It makes no sense.
Oh, so I want to mention the really horrible raid that happened. And everyone now knows that the... daughter or the half-sister of Abdulrahman al-Awlaki Nawar was killed in the SEAL raid that Trump, and it turns out Steve Bannon and Jared Kushner were involved in greenlighting.
Why is Steve Bannon involved in any of this?
I know.
Like, why is he military? Why is he doing anything related to military strategy? Why?
This is where kill by committee really becomes so perverse. Yeah. I mean, I just imagine like Trump sitting there like showing these baseball cards, which is what we call them, and be like, should we go after this guy? And Jared Kushner's like, yeah, sure, Pops. Why not? I mean, because he's like, you're my father-in-law. Sure. And then like show it to Stephen Bannon. He's like, yeah, we got to go get those fuckers. And then,
Steve Bannon's never going to say no. Like, you know what I mean? He's never going to be a voice of restraint, like, ever. It's just...
And then, like, those are the ones that make the decision, and, like, they have no military expertise.
None! They're fucking imbeciles!
And so, And there were probably other people who we talked to, but we know that those two people were at the table when the decision was made and were part of the decision making, and then they got nothing. They have nothing, and they're lying so much about what happened. You know, dozens of people were killed in this village, but it was also a site in Yemen. This is what Barash Shaban, who's been on our show before, and he's with Reprieve, was talking about. This was a site in 2013 where they bombed a wedding party with a drone.
Yeah, and I believe according to that Reprieve report, one of the guys who survived that wedding attack died this time, killed this time.
Yes. And the daughter, he lost children. So the wife is still alive, but children of theirs were also killed.
Man, the U.S. really hates the Alaki family, like a lot. They just keep, killing them. What the fuck? I'm sorry. I just, don't know how to... It doesn't seem real.
And that, again, with the SEAL team being involved, and this is something that Donald Trump, I believe, is going to be heavily dependent on. But, you know, that's a legacy of Barack Obama that we'll have to grapple with.
The poorest country. Yemen's the poorest country in the whole region. The poorest. It's on the brink of, famine. I mean, that's insane. You're launching a raid. That's what they're deciding to do is, launch raids as they're still arming the Saudis to, systematically destroy it. I mean, this administration is full of shit. I almost just, want to go, I just want to shake Trump's supporters and be like, he's not making it better. He's making it worse. He's, empowering the people that you claim to hate so much. I just want to shake them. It just, I mean, this is just so crazy to watch, and it really feels like, I don't know if you can relate to this, but it's like watching everything happening, I feel so powerless. I mean, it's been nice to go to protests and stuff. It has been really encouraging and inspiring to see all that, the sort of explosion in activism. But even then, I'm just sitting back and I'm so tired and exhausted because it's every day, it's five apocalyptic new executive orders. And another a Yemen raid where they just killed a pregnant woman and a bunch of kids and then called them Al-Qaeda. And God knows what's up next. You can't even keep up. It really is so disturbing. And I got to see Bernie Sanders talk a couple days ago at this conference. And even Sanders, said that he's worried about how Trump, in order to maintain the way that demagogues win is by making people scared and making them hate, making them scared and making them hate. And he was like, and Trump, it's not going to last long enough. He might have to actually, he's worried that Trump is going to go to war to try and maintain the fear.
I think that all of that is completely possible. But as the resident optimist of the Unauthorized Disclosure podcast,
I'm just sitting in a cave in a dark room crying. And Kevin's like, here's some sun, Rania.
And as the resident optimist, as I said to somebody, somebody came in. So if you believe that everything that we're doing is all for naught and ultimately fascism is going to win, then I believe that's a self-fulfilling prophecy and that actually fascism will win.
No, I don't think it will. And you're right.
And I know that that's a very basic and maybe sort of overly simplistic way to address what you're saying. I mean, what you're saying is very valid and concerning, but I think everyone is concerned. Does that make
sense? Yeah, they are. That's a good thing.
So here's the thing that I've been clinging on to, and it makes me very optimistic, which is the fact that none of what Trump is doing seems to be accepted as normal or even remotely reasonable as a way of handling your first days as president. Now, everyone's positively disturbed, if that can be a positive thing, because they know that this is so. All this stuff that he's doing with so much swiftness, I don't know how that becomes lasting and embedded in his government as part of his administration, because the way that he's doing it is leading to such an intense visceral reaction by everybody. So I just, even if you tell me that Republicans have majorities in Congress and they have the White House and he's putting people on the Supreme Court, I still don't actually buy the fact that, like, what he's doing is going to become wholly entrenched in our government because it doesn't have popular support. I mean, for the, like, but that's where we come in. Like, that's where we're the wild card. Like, we have to be leaders. We have to be clear in what we're saying. So just to bring it all back to the way we started our show, and we're going way over on this podcast, but everyone who supports us is getting much more podcasts this week, so I hope they enjoy it. I think to bring it back to the band is that, like, yeah, you have to make those connections. You have to really be clear to people about, like, why, okay, we understand why you feel afraid. It's not completely off base for you to be afraid that the people that we've been attacking want to come to our country and attack us here mm-hmm. in the United States. That isn't a wholly irrational fear. However, we then have to walk them through why a Muslim ban is not the answer to dealing with those people.
Yeah, no, exactly. Exactly. We do need to do that. And actually, you know, I had an Uber driver, well, Lyft driver, because I wasn't using Uber.
You better not be using Uber.
Yeah,
we're
going like,
to lose all kinds of patrons.
Yeah, no. I had a Lyft, but surprisingly, no. Like, usually, the drivers are always pretty liberal. Like, in the D.C. area are always pretty liberal people. But this guy was a total Trump supporter. And he did, and I was, like, surprised to hear he was, like, really disgusted by the ban. Like, the way it went about and how it, like, happened. And that's one thing, too, is, like, what I'm saying is Trump has actually lost support, I think.
Well, and that's good because look, all of these things that he's doing from his pen, just, you know, by scribbling on a piece of paper and then waving it at us really dopeyly, is unnecessary. I mean, he if he has power and can get these things through Congress, why isn't he waiting? Well, he's impatient and he's a petulant kind of a person who just wants to do it himself, who just wants to be the one to claim all of the – so he owns all of this. And maybe the Republican Party is happy that he owns most of everything that he's already done because they can sort of distance themselves and play this sort of, like, game. And that's maybe more for us to get into in a later show. I wanted to end on a light.
Well, wait, hold on. Are you sure? Because first, maybe we can I think we have Frederick Douglass on the line.
Yeah.
To give us his take on what's going on. He is still alive, right?
Yeah. Yes. I am hearing that he's with someone named Harriet Tubman. They're going steady, and they're about to
join a Tea Party protest.
Right.
My God!
Against the IRS because it's the civil rights movement of their time of our time. I mean, we've got to restore property rights to all of America.
Yes, exactly. And I got, oh my God, Kevin, like, what the fuck? Like, that, I cannot believe this happened.
The Black History Month event.
Yeah.
That's how we wanted to end our show.
Oh, Trump is an idiot. He doesn't know what, like, he's like, did he really, he thinks Frederick, like, does he think, he thought Frederick Douglass might still be alive? Like, is that, how is that? And then there was some bowling, like, that, like, a massacre that lady Kellyanne just, like, made up.
The Bowling Green Massacre.
Yeah, like, whoa! Like, two Iraqi refugees came and just did a massacre in Bowling Green, what, Ohio?
Right.
Or something, some place. I'm like, just made it up. That never happened.
Yep,
like, ever.
They just are making this up. As they go along, and
there's not even like a one little piece of kernel of something that maybe kind of sort of happened that she just embellished. Like, that just never fucking happened, ever. Like, she complete fabrication.
It's so amazing. So if you'll permit me to grandstand, I wrote a thing for this Black History Month event. Do you mind if I? It'll take like a minute.
Do it.
Okay, here. So. Well, this is Black History Month, so this is our little breakfast, so this is our get-together. Have you ever heard anything so ridiculous in your life? I wrote a thing, so this is coming from Trump, and he continues. It comes after January and right before March.
We celebrate your incredible history because, you know, your people have really come a long way since the first days of our country when the founding fathers started America and put us on a path toward greatness. We lost our foothold and now we're getting back to what really made this country great. That was my campaign. Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., you know, he's someone we celebrated last month. Frederick Douglass, well, that's an example of somebody who's done an amazing job that is being recognized more and more. There's Thomas Jefferson and Abraham Lincoln and then Martin Luther King, and they really left their mark on history. This country doesn't make civil rights heroes like it used to, but... So it's Black History Month, and you're at my event for Black History Month. It's an African-American listening session, so you'll listen, or I guess I'll listen to you. There's now a museum here in D.C. for this. I hear it's wonderful, and maybe I'll go sometime. It has Martin Luther King, Douglas, Harriet Tubman is in there. She's just a fabulous person who gets some credit. Not enough credit. Rosa Parks, of course. We all know she did that thing where she sat down on a bus. Does anyone here know Malcolm X? Do they like Malcolm X? Some people like Malcolm X, but you put an X in your name, and that's bad judgment. Just bad judgment. Then there's mayhem coming to our inner cities and high rates of murder. But we have Steve Harvey and Ben Carson, so we're going to take care of our inner city people. I like Tiger Woods, though his game is a mess these days. Probably has something to do with the media and getting a bad rap. I don't watch CNN, but did you see what CNN said the other day? Fake news, I say. Anyways, Dennis Rodman, we've kept in touch because, of course, I had him on The Apprentice a few times. We may use him in North Korea because he's just been fantastic with the people there. The people just love him. And that's how I
Dude, Kevin, you could actually, like, have a career in writing speeches for this guy.
I think, like...
That's a little too good.
That's Donald Trump's Black history. That's... I mean, that's basically what I heard when Donald Trump started rambling. That and the last thing before we wrap our show, the fact that some Ohio pastor, Black pastor, do you know about this, Rania?
No.
Got, like, so... he basically, like, made up that he had talked to, and he said, quote-unquote, top gang thugs in Chicago. And that these people were willing to sit down with Donald Trump and they might stop contributing to the body count in Chicago if he would come to the table and they would talk about how they could bring some jobs or like programs to this south side of Chicago.
Wow.
And like the pastor like made it up. And like later on, they like followed up with him. And he was like, I guess I was just tired.
Oh my God, Kevin, I give up. We're going to have to bring your optimism back next week because, wow, man, this country,
all right,
it's really going places.
We went really long, but I'm sure you will enjoy all of it. So thank you, everyone, for listening. Again, we appreciate all the support that we're getting for our show, all the donations. And, I went through and we thanked everyone who supported our show individually this past month. And we'll continue to show gratitude to all of you because we think it's really great that we have your support.
Yeah. And we will be back next week.